Tonight's a really special night because it's with Dr. Jacqueline Allen and the incredible and amazing Jackie Allen, because we all know her on diabetes Twitter and all her work with disordered eating. But I've written out a piece for her intro, and Jack, I hope it's okay, and I'm going to read it anyway. Jacqueline Allen is...
Not yourself.
I'm here with my fingers crossed as well. is a diabetes psychologist who also is an associate lecturer at Birkbeck University of London and has been in this role since January 2022. She has worked at King's College London as a trainee clinical psychologist until recently. Since 2009, Jacqueline is the co-founder of Diabetics with Eating Disorders, or better known as DWED, a charity that provided support but raises awareness, advocates for change, and shares personal experiences with diabetes and eating disorders. Jack completed her first PhD from Birkbeck University of London, where she studied eating disorders in type 1 diabetes. She has highlighted the lack of knowledge in this area for people with type 1 diabetes and the need for her to pursue multiple PhDs to further awareness in this area. She has also been the PPI coordinator for the STEADY project, that's NIHR funded, since March 2018, I think. Jack's lived experience, work, and compassion for the type 1 diabetes community, who are feeling this impact of the combination of this condition tied to disordered eating, has been instrumental to the awareness of the seriousness and the prevalence of type 1 disordered eating, resulting in official recognition of insulin omission as part of symptoms for disordered eating in the DSM. And this is the DSM. I didn't write down what this stands for, and Jack, you can tell us, because I should have written that down too, because that would make me sound more knowledgeable in this, and I'm not. But I know that it is a list of official symptoms for mental health or something like that. And also a very important section in the NICE guidance, which we are more familiar with. But Jack, you're very welcome, and thank you for coming tonight. I hope I did okay. Yeah.
That's I'm sorry, Mary, I've been around for a while. It's a bit difficult.
It's quite difficult. Sorry, it's
yeah. Also, sorry. What you were saying about the DSM, it'd be good if we could talk about that at some point, because I'm surprise, surprise, very disappointed in the overall representation in the DSM for disorders in type 1 diabetes. But it's a really, really interesting story that we have there that I will tell if we have time.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to it. So I'm going to pass you over to Kez, who's going to take you through a quiz stop, not 90 seconds, but don't we call it our 90 seconds? But
we need a new name. Basically, it started as a 90 second element where we ask quick fire questions in 90 seconds, but then it just lasted forever. So if anyone can think of a new name for it, it's meant to be a quick fire section, but hey, we love to chat. So over to you, Kez.
Yeah.
So Jack, really, it's just a bit of like getting to know you really, in relation to diabetes. So, I mean, Mary's already kind of answered the first question for you about your name and occupation. So we'll move on to question two. When were you diagnosed and how old were you?
This is really bad. Sorry, this is not going to take 90 seconds, because I was either 23 or 24. I actually can't remember. So it was either 22 or 23. So it was 2003 or 2004. I'm not sure.
I think I was a little bit like that in the beginning as well, to be fair.
Yeah, I think I've trauma blocked out that entire 2 years. So at some point in those 2 years, yeah.
Do you finger prick or use smart technology?
I'm very lucky. I have a closed loop sluice system. I use a Dexcom and I use the Tandem T-Slim, but I am also in the process of getting my own diabetic alert dog that I'm training up privately because they have been failing me overnight.
Reminder, what was your dog's name? That's not one of the questions, but I love it.
His name is Keto.
I think that's amazing.
That is incredible.
When and if you do finger prick, do you change your lancet each time, honestly?
Not since at least 2012.
Okay. Are you hypo and hyper aware?
I wasn't. I completely lost my hypo awareness until I went on the closed loop, and then it came back rapidly. So I am now hypo aware. But that overnight, I am hypo unaware.
Okay. And what symptoms would you have for each of those?
I'm really lucky now that my hypo symptoms are just really general. They're just the same as they were when I first was diagnosed. Shaky. I get very fight or flighty. Like, there was a joke at my old work that, oh, Jack's in the hypo corner, because I used to just sit under my desk and call my mum.
Oh.
I was first diagnosed, not very great when you're the manager of the department, but hey ho, we all do what must. So but now, to be honest, I'm very rarely hypo when I'm conscious, like during the day, because the tech hour is so good. I normally pick up my symptoms before my Dexcom does, so usually around about 4.55 I can tell where I am. However, overnight I also have a sleep disorder, and so I sleep through the alarms, and usually by that point I'm low, as in L-O, so it's incredibly difficult and a bit scary.
Yeah, that does sound really scary actually, if it was happening a lot as well.
Yeah, 3 or 4 times a week at the moment, which is not great.
Oh, bless. That's awful. I can't even imagine, like, twice or once or twice would literally be me done.
Yeah. Hence keto. Yeah,
absolutely. What is your go-to hypo treatment?
Oh my God, I'm so bougie. Everyone's going to take the piss out of me for this. I drink lemon or orange San Pellegrino.
Okay, that's interesting.
Ooh, swish.
Look, hypos absolutely suck. Coke sucks. San Pellegrino is really tasty. It's a bit on the expensive side, and I've definitely been feeling the pinch that I'm having them all overnight and just like waking up covered in San Pellegrino. But yeah, I do have bougie hypos. I also live with gastroparesis, so like eating something doesn't work.
Yeah.
It has to be fast fluids.
I love the sound of the San Pellegrino stuff. Like, why would you not drink stuff that's lovely? Yeah.
And also, it's perfect. It's the perfect size. They're not those big chunky cans. They're like the little slim cans. And they're obviously they have 25 grams of sugar in them. And personally, for me, 15 grams is never enough. And I don't know if that's because of my gastroparesis or whatnot. So San Pellegrino keeps me just 25 grams on the safe side, and it's delicious.
Yeah, I'm getting some. I love your way of thinking with that.
Yeah, literally, I was just thinking, now everyone knows what I'm buying in the morning. I'm gonna give that a go.
the orange and the lemon ones are just chef's kiss, but you have to be careful because very recently San Pellegrino brought out a light version, and I was very annoyed because I bought the light version and then it was absolutely no use, and if I'm being really honest, not as tasty.
Oh, that is annoying. I will check when I pick it up. What do you think is worse, feeling hypo or hyper?
That's still really difficult. I think at the moment, obviously, for me, it's hypo, but that's because my hypos at the moment are so devastating. But I previously lived my life completely hyperglycemic, and it was horrendous. It's just like, it's like being hungover with none of the fun night before all of the time. Yeah. And no matter what I did, I could never get my time and range to anything like 50 or 60%. So I'm saying hypo now, but that's, I feel that kind of the days of hypers are behind me. So the grass is always greener, right?
Yeah, absolutely. What is one thing that you like about diabetes, if anything?
What, you mean the fact that I've got a whole, my entire job? I mean, the thing is that, like, diabetes completely not really changed my life 180 degrees. I was very much going in one direction, and then diabetes and consequently diabulimia came and literally turned my entire life around. And I am very lucky to have survived that. So I love now that I get to help other people with type 1 diabetes. It's the best job in the world. I spent a year and a half of my training working with people, young people and adults with type 1 diabetes. And I'm off to work with children next as my first sort of job post-training. All my research, I never in a million years would have believed that I, the crazy musician, would be doing structural equation modelling, but it's kind of opened my eyes to what is possible when you love the community that you're a part of. I guess I love the community, and I love working in this area, and that's why I've done it since every day since 2008. So the community and the ability to affect change, I think.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Great summary at the end. I like that. That's really good. I mean, it's hard to say one thing, I guess, but it is just one thing that you don't like about diabetes.
I mean, actually, that's really, not to get too deep too quickly, but obviously I've lost a lot of people to this illness, and it hits like a gut punch every time. So I think the unnecessary loss caused by diabulimia has been the worst thing for me to witness.
Yeah. And I think that's something that we're gonna talk about in a little bit more detail in a few minutes. So Mary is now going to move on to the section around diagnosis and journey. So I'll hand over to Mary.
Thank you. Yeah, so when you were diagnosed, Jack, what symptoms did you have? I'm saying this now, and I'm actually kind of going back to your answers to the 2003, 2004, and whether you were 23 or 24 and you're blocking it out. Do you remember your diagnosis?
Yeah, it was really awful. I'd worked in a pharmacy when I was young, and I was always really interested in medical conditions. And so I was like a dispensary girl. So when we were going through people's medications, I would always be like, what's that for? What's that for? Like an insatiable curiosity, if you like, about that sort of stuff. And so when out of nowhere, I started like losing weight, I was really hungry. I knew that in my head at first, I was like, oh, wow, the diet that I've been on is working. And yeah. But then I woke up one day and I couldn't see. Like everything was blurred. I was peeing on the hour every hour. And I went to the doctor, the GP, and I said, I think I have diabetes. And the GP that I saw took one look at me, looked at me up and down and said, no, you're too thin for type 1, you're too old for type 2, and sent me away. And what? Yeah, and a very short while later, I was very, very unwell. Off to the hospital, in DKA, and diagnosed with type 1. So I kind of guess in that sense I was immediately on the back foot. Like I was sort of born into diabetes with a natural mistrust of the healthcare system, and definitely with an aversion to doctors, medical doctors telling me what was and what wasn't.
Yeah.
So the symptoms were all, you know, rock standard. But I knew it wasn't right. And the
that's really interesting.
Me. Yeah.
Like from that, from the get go, you're already not trusting the care system. How long did you spend in hospital when you were diagnosed?
I was there for a few days, and then I was taken into, I was at St. Thomas's. And St. Thomas's, I have to say, were really good. After I'd been in the hospital, they were then really good. They saw me, I think, I was in the outpatients department with the clinic every day for like a week, and then
you weren't actually admitted though.
I was, but that wasn't when I was. So I was diagnosed when I was admitted.
Yeah.
And then when I was released, I was in outpatients. I was at diabetes St. Thomas's clinic.
Okay. Yes. I understand.
Right. So by the time I got like through that, and there were other things going on in my life at that time as well. But once I got through that and I was actually in the clinic were very, very good. But that initial dismissal meant that I was much sicker than I needed to be by the time I was diagnosed.
Yeah.
And also I'd been through rapid weight loss.
Yeah.
Weight loss that I couldn't have dreamed of when I was anorexic or bulimic. So by the time I was diagnosed, I'd lost a significant portion of my body weight.
Wow.
And as someone who, I mean, the irony was I'd fought through most of my teen years with anorexia or bulimia on or off. And I'd just gotten to the stage where I think I was like finally coming out of it. I'd been in recovery for a year, and then bang. Here comes this massive weight loss. And of course, the first thing that happened when I was diagnosed, they put me on a drip and all the weight started going back on. And immediately I was like, I'm not doing this.
Yeah,
I'm not doing this. Insulin. And in my head, what that equated to was that medication's making me fat.
Yeah.
Like, not lack of that medication has nearly killed me. No, because I was so happy with the weight loss. I didn't really care in a way. I didn't really care that I nearly died, because I was like, this is brilliant. With this weight, I can't shift it. And now it's just gone.
I see. Yeah. And so you're 23 and 20, you're 23, 24 at this stage.
I was 23 when I was diagnosed. It was 2004. Yes, I was 23 when I was diagnosed. Yeah, that's right.
And like you say, St. Thomas, is that guys in St. Thomas's in London?
Yes, and I was in St. Thomas's. Yep.
So you're clearly not from London, and like your family are they up in Scotland?
Yes, but I'd lived in London at that point for years. I've moved down sort of 1999, 2000, and I was grateful that they weren't around when I was diagnosed.
How did they deal with your diagnosis then?
Well, they didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, to be fair to them, I was an adult.
Yeah.
I'd done my first degree. In fact, it was 2003, so I was coming to the end of my first degree. And, you know, like, I was not mentally in a particularly good place anyway, so I was dealing with it very much on my own.
Mm-hmm. And they didn't really know any of the detail, or just that. That doesn't even matter. That isn't even a question. I'm not even asking you that question.
But you're right, because it's something that, because I'd sort of decided I was going to deal with it on my own and not really talk to anyone about it, it meant that when I did develop diabulimia, it was so easy to sort of get away with it, because I was saying things like, oh, I've had a diabetes attack.
I understand. I understand. I totally get that, because I was 18 and my first term in Queens when I was diagnosed. My family were hours away, miles away, and they don't know about like anything about type 1 at all. Like, so you could tell them anything.
I don't get me wrong, like, I love them to death now, but it wasn't easy at that point in my life. And it was sort of like one of those things, like when the first time I had a hypo in front of my dad, he was like, come on, we can sit down and talk about this. And I, you know, I think I remember something like flying past his head, sort of like after that. And you know, so it was very much like I kept it to myself. I was, you know, my musical career was taking off, and I didn't want it to get in the way of anything.
So yeah, you've mentioned being a crazy musician, and now you're a psychologist and doing clinical psychology. Is that right? I get mixed up between psychology and psychiatry. That's wrong, isn't it? So you're a clinical psychologist.
I'm just, well, hopefully I've got my Bible on Friday. So.
Yes, yeah.
So if all goes well, I'll be a clinical academic psychologist. So the academic part is the PhD and the clinical psychology is the clinical doctorate. So I'll be an academic clinical psychologist, yeah.
Do you know that made no sense to anybody here? Or maybe it did. I'm just speaking for myself.
Sorry. So that it will become clearer, I think, when I explain my career.
Yeah, so you... like 23, 24, crazy musician. What kind of crazy musician stuff were you doing? Sorry, this is not about diabetes, Chad. This is just the before.
No, I mean, I've been in bands. Like, I started playing piano when I was 3. I can muddle my way through on most instruments. But I piano was what I sort of, that was my first instrument, and singing is probably my second. But I joined a band, and we were scouted really quickly, and we were signed within the first year or so, and we were always doing like showcases, and we were always in the press, and people were always taking pictures of me, which was a big thing that I hated. And so, yeah, so that's what I was doing. But as the sort of diabulimia took hold, it was one of those things where the bigger the band got, the smaller I got. And like I remember coming straight off stage one night and walking straight into the back of an ambulance.
Wow.
So, and you know, every time I tried to get better, and I knew that I would have to put on some weight because I was so severely underweight, there'd be a photo shoot or something would come up that would really sort of, so I took a break from the band and then never went back. And it's actually at that point that I decided to set it up Dwight.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to talk about Dwight a bit later on, and I don't want to start talking about that until like but I'll, because that's meaty.
Teensy bit.
Right. I talked about your diagnosis and early days with type 1, mentioned about how you manage your type 1 with a closed loop and wee keto who's on the way. He's like this little bundle of joy coming.
I know. I can't, I literally can't wait. I'm so overexcited about it.
Oh, you'll have to tweet another photograph of us or maybe totally keep us all in the loop with him.
He's gonna be internet famous by the time I'm finished with him. You know that.
Yeah.
Although I am going to I'm going to work with diabetic kids next, so I'm like thinking, how much do I let them know about like puppies? Because if I let them know about puppies, I'm going to have some very angry parents on my hands. Mm. What do you mean your psychologist has a puppy to help? Doesn't come across them. Yeah. Sorry, guys. So I have to think about how I'm going to phrase that with the patients.
I know, but you do have to tell your own story as well, like, too. But yeah, I understand. See, with your closed loop, with your hyper closed loop, how is that helping you every day now compared to before?
Well, my time in range is now regularly in the 90s. Wow. The thing that it's really put the kibosh on is the gastroparesis, because obviously with gastro you don't know when the food's going to develop, when the food's going to digest.
Yeah.
So you just get random highs and lows out of everywhere. So I'm really conservative on how much insulin that I use, and I just let the closed loop take care of the rest.
And you still manage to get 90%? That's amazing.
Yeah. I'm constantly between 90 and 100%.
Yeah.
Whereas before, when I was trying to do it myself, even, and I've done everything, low FODMAP, high fiber, low carb, high carb, low fiber, you know, no carb, 40 grams of carb, 300 grams of carb, you know, a list elimination diet, that elimination diet, being on Ensures every day for 3 weeks, nothing was working. Nothing was working. So it has massively changed. I think it's increased my lifespan, if I'm being like really honest about it, because
yep.
My blood sugars were so crazy before. And also it used to scare me because I would have to go to work like that, you know, and especially working in the diabetes space, it's really difficult as well to think, you know, when your blood sugar is sitting at 25 and you're trying to concentrate on someone, and then you need to pee again for the fifth time that hour. It was just really infuriating. And I think I was almost like constantly in diabetes burnout.
And you know, I find those words that you're using really interesting, because you have the awareness of lived experience, but the awareness of supporting somebody who is in diabetes distress, like, and needing you, or doesn't need, but needing you switched on for their diabetes, for their type 1, or maybe just whatever, you maybe deal with lots of different types of diabetes. But you have that really like big spotlight on that. And there's a system that is helping you have clarity, and I'm going to say the word stability, but like more stability that everybody should have, because we all do important jobs, like, because you don't have to have type 1 and help type 1 to know how important the system is, like whether you're like a childcare worker or working in the supermarket, like in supporting your family, like you need that system if you need that system.
Don't even get me started on the guilt that I feel, because sometimes the guilt that I feel just for being able to have access to a system.
No, there's no guilt for that. You need that. Everybody needs that.
I know that. I know that, but it still feels sometimes, especially when I'm working with someone with type 1 who's really struggling, and I'm not a medic, right? So because I'm not a medic, I can't turn around and go, ask about a pump. Do you know what I mean?
Can you not write a note, like a post-it note, going, like, here, go ask.
Like, literally sometimes think, ah, this is so unfair. And then of course, but then you're in the territory of like, how boundaried are you as a healthcare professional? You know, like, yeah. because and every single person that I've come, especially, and there's quite a few psychologists with type 1 diabetes that work with type 1 diabetes, has a totally different answer for how to deal with this in session. Like, I've come across people like, absolutely no way would I tell my patients I also live with type 1. And then there's also me, who, like, I'm all over the internet. There's absolutely no point. Do you know what I mean? All anyone would have to do is Google me to see that they're...
That's exactly where my brain went. It was like, exactly. You're out there. Hello.
Yeah, exactly. But there's no right way of doing that. But what it does mean is that when you wear a lot of hats, sometimes being able to separate those hats is quite difficult. Let me tell you when it's really difficult, when you're sitting with a blood sugar of 25.
Oh my word, yes, I imagine.
So I think that's something that I've become more and more adept at since I started stepping back from DWED and navigating into a more clinical role. But whether or not that's actually been more beneficial for my patients, I'll never know. There is also a massive... It's not... Do you know what? It's not guilt per se. It's more like, I just wish that this was available for everyone and everyone knew. Yes. Like, everyone knew. Like, I've been dissuaded in some circles from speaking about it because maybe it's not available in that area.
Resources. Well, it's just down to resources.
Yeah. But that's not who. So what? What's that got to do with the patient? The patient has a right to be informed.
Exactly.
And the more patients that are informed, and the more patients that there are to put pressure on whatever that, you know, local health authorities or whatever, that are saying it's not resourced, because we all know that's not a valid excuse.
I know they're not hearing that it's resourced, though. They're hearing that they don't need it because those that need it are over a certain criteria, or they're
different or that they don't fit into the criteria that have access to it. And then even those that do, it is a waiting list. And yeah, exactly. It's like that's those words. It's not guilt. You just wish exactly. Everybody had.
Yeah. Yeah, and but I think it does make me feel personally guilty because I've seen the difference that it's made in my life, mm-hmm. And it does, it is, and I hate that, you know, like I know that we're all, there's this whole thing about, oh, don't be woke, but it is, if you're a type 1 diabetic and you have all the bells and whistles in the tech, then even like for me, I got that because I had no hypoglycemia awareness and I have gastroparesis, it's still a point of privilege.
Yeah,
it's still a point of privilege that you're in an area that sees this, that is forward thinking. It's still a point of privilege that you have a consultant who knows that if you don't get what you want, you're going to harass him until you do. Mm-hmm. You know, like these are all points of privilege.
Once you move to a hospital, you move yourself to a hospital because you are allowed to within the NHS to a hospital that will offer a pump and wait your turn to try and get on, like to get on that list and wait, because like lots of hospitals don't even offer pumps.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be like that, and I think we all know that it shouldn't be like that, but it then becomes confusing when you are now in the system and part of the system, especially like when I've been a very vocal patient advocate and I've historically spoken about how ridiculously traumatized I've been by that system, you know, that system that now pays my bills.
So, exactly.
It is a tightrope.
So you like you talk about like dealing with higher blood sugars in your working life and then previously being like living your life as a like somebody with really high blood sugars, and like how has that how have you managed that, like how did you manage that like that, or even in a more normal way? Normal, what is normal? Gosh, Mary, that's a stupid word.
Don't worry, I'm not judging you, don't worry.
You know, like today, even like where you're changing roles, Friday's happening, you got your Viva on Friday. I'm just imagining standing in your shoes, important week, and you're talking here on Diabetes Chat to us, and thank you so much. But like big things happening this week, starting a new job, congratulations on your new job as well, and working with children and lots of exciting things. Exciting things do different things with your blood sugars.
Yeah. But I'm lucky because you just remember who you're doing it for.
Yeah.
It's really as simple as that. You just remember who you're doing it for. And it's all, you know, when we're fighting to change the system, we're not doing it necessarily for ourselves all the time. Like, ironically, I'm not actually that great for advocating for my own care. Sometimes it just all gets too much and I can't be bothered, you know, but you remember in terms of your work who you're doing it for, and that's how I manage, and it's what I try and remind myself before any interaction, which is difficult because I also live with ADHD myself and I'm ridiculously verbally impulsive most of the time, which gets worse when my blood sugars are out of whack, but I do just remind myself who I'm doing it for.
When do you advocate for yourself?
I'm not very, to be honest, at the moment I've been struggling with it because I don't know, like anyone here who's listening will know, once you start racking up comorbidities, the system doesn't work. It doesn't work. The more, it doesn't talk to each other. The more comorbidities you have, the more people, it really is too many chefs and all of that. So one of the things that I've had, like I had towards the end of my doctorate, the second one, I had to go part-time because one day a week I'm a medical PA for myself. That's ridiculously, I mean, I've got a psychiatrist who deals with my sleep and my ADHD. I've got a cardiologist who deals with my heart disease. I've got a gastroenterologist who deals with my stomach and bowel issues. I've got my diabetes clinic. And then on top of that, there's the regional stuff, like the eye bridges. Where does my eye clinic go now? So, and so one day a week, I'm my own medical PA. And so I eventually had to say to my work, I'm not coping, because the other day of the week that I've got off, I went down to 3 days a week, I'm in clinic. Like, I've got a heart clinic here, I've got an angiogram there. I mean, it's like the crap version of Old MacDonald Had a Farm. Do you know what I mean? My healthcare. And every week it's a different procedure, it's a different appointment. And that
Different location,
yeah. And that then starts taking a mental toll. It starts, and that then, for me, that's when it starts seeping into my work, especially when I've got patients who are coming in and going, I'm so frustrated at the NHS. And I'm like, me too!
But that gives you this is a silver lining. That gives you fire, must give you such a fire in your belly.
I mean, of course it does. But what it does mean is that I have to be really careful about how I manage my time. So yes, that's why I went down to part-time, and my new job is part-time. Again, though, I'm in a privileged position. I can do that. I'm not supporting a family. I'm supporting a cat and a soon-to-be dog, and my partner makes significantly more money than me. So I'm in the position to be able to look after myself now.
You've worked very hard to get there too.
I have worked very hard, but there have also been structural things that I have definitely benefited from. For example, like, I was able, when I was doing my PhD, I was able to take on volunteer work because I had a fully funded PhD and I was lecturing, which meant that I could afford to do the volunteer work, which gave me the clinical experience to apply for the clinical doctorate. Yeah. So it is a weird situation. So how I look after myself actually now, more than anything else, is I protect my time. That's how I look after myself.
That's a really good thing, actually, because I've written that down for myself. Just, you know, you give a busy person something, like, if you want it done. So
yeah, get to the busiest person in the room. And that was me for the best part of a decade. And now, but here's the thing. It took me a year longer to get my PhD. It's taken me six months longer to get my DCLIN. I extended my bachelor's, my undergraduate, by a year. So, like, I've been sort of doing, that used to make me feel really guilty. Oh, it's going to take me more time to do this. Actually, I live in a body, I live in a disabled body. I have a neurodivergent mind. So I just accept that now. And that's how I try and look after myself, is to not beat myself up and to protect my time. And to not force myself to do more than I'm capable of, because that's how you get burnt. That's how I end up in burnout.
Yeah. What do you wish you'd known when you were newly diagnosed to help you today, or help you then, that you know today? Because, like, you've come a long way.
That's really difficult. I would have got myself into therapy immediately with a very, very good and qualified therapist. Someone who has a registration body. And because I saw a few people who weren't qualified, and it did me more harm than good. And to sort of say, look, I live in a diabetic body. I need a team, or especially for the psychiatric stuff that I've experienced and psychological stuff that I've experienced, I want a specialist. Because
How do you find them?
I think for me, eventually, I went, again, because I'm lucky enough to afford it, I went private. I found a private psychologist. But there are some, diabetes psychology is becoming much bigger now. And there are some massive advocates for it in the community, in the four nations. I mean, I can reel off the top of my head, Rose Stewart, my old boss.
Yes.
Like, she's absolutely incredible. And the work that she does at, like, a policy level, at national policy levels, people don't understand how much work goes in behind the scenes for all of the extra things that she does. Like, she's just recently published a roadmap for the whole of, like, diabetes psychology in Wales. and how you do that and what stepped care and diabetes psychology looks like. Glieda Ishmael in London, obviously. Who else? Kirsty McLennan in Scotland. There are people out there. So I, but again, it's a bit of a postcode lottery as to whether or not your diabetes team has access to a diabetes specialist psychologist. And I think that that's something that as a community, and I'm biased here, obviously I'm biased, I'm a psychologist, but I became this for a reason, right? Like, I chose this path because I thought that's where the need is. And I think we need to get better as a community to sort of say, diabetes psychology isn't quote unquote nice to have, because the only complication that we're all going to get, every single one of us, is diabetes specific distress. We're not all going to get neuropathy. We're not all going to get gastroparesis. Not all of us are going to develop eye problems, but every single one of us will hit burnout at some point. And you need diabetes psychology to deal with that.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think we have all been conditioned. Anybody who has been diagnosed, say, I'll even say more than 5 years, right? Anybody diagnosed recently or post-pandemic, they're a little bit more attuned to the mental health side of things and capturing people and bringing them on. But if you've been diagnosed pre-COVID, you're a little bit forgotten. But when you're a little bit forgotten, and these are the wrong words to describe this, because it's not that they intentionally forget us, but we condition ourselves that we don't have diabetes distress, or like, because we're not depressed. It's like this is our type one, you can't take it away, like it's there, so you learn to live with it.
Yeah, like I'm glad you brought that up though, Mary, because so Jackie Sturt is a professor of diabetes nursing at King's College in London, and she was one of the people to sort of say, look, what the patients are coming in with isn't depression. Mm-hmm. We're calling it depression, but this is very specifically linked to diabetes. This is diabetes-specific distress. And so that's that's the thing, is that diabetes-specific distress, it's unique to us. And that's why a lot of people, when they go through diabetes-specific distress, they might get misdiagnosed. Anxiety, depression. It's not. It's a very unique phenomenon.
I know. And I even remember like thinking, oh, do you know when you're going through a bit of a down? I'm going to say a bit of a down, not a total down, like just even a bit of a down. You go, oh, I could go see some. I could go and say it to the GP. But like what is his resolution? Like to give me something? And like, sure, that's not going to make it go away. And you almost just need to talk about it, like to somebody who actually gets it and understands. And then I don't even know what you're not going to get. You can't even see the solution to it, like by going to a normal GP or.
Isn't that then in the way that we speak to, because this is, and okay, this is me jumping in with my advocate hat on. Is that the answer to me, like for me now, how I would go about that is I would go, if I went to my diabetes team or if I went to my GP, and I'd say, I need to see a psychologist who specializes in diabetes. No ifs, no buts, no IAPT. I need a diabetes specialist psychologist. And if that's not available in the area, then there's some questions around why not.
I know. And like my head goes, this is a bit like where that session, whether it'll be a half an hour session with a diabetes psychologist, will be like taking two paracetamol and there is no migraine or there is no major headache that keeps you out of work or like just keeps you moving along. And like, but if you don't take those two paracetamol, you need the ibuprofen, like all the bits and bobs, because it's gone further than you thought it was ever going to go.
Well, I think that's the other thing as well, is that like I see diabetes distress for me is unique, but it's unique. When I say it's unique to us as people with type 1 diabetes, but it's universal, and it might not all pop up in everyone in the same way. But
Talk about diabetes distress a bit more. Maybe put words into it.
So I the thing is, I've been struggling to define it, because I spoke about it in my most recent doctoral thesis. But what I said there, and I think this is what I will. Somebody asked me to use an example from a textbook, and I said, no, I'm going to stick with what I think it is. Thanks. I think it's any dysphoria relating to your type one.
Yeah.
So there's loads of different ways to conceptualize it, but really it's any dysphoria relating to your type one. So there are scales to measure it, like the diabetes distress scale by Bill Polonsky, who is a brilliant man who works out of the Behavioral Diabetes Institute in the States. And it's recently been updated to, there's a type one specific one now, rather than just having one for both types. Then there is a guy called, I think he's called Daniel Ehrman, and he's been doing some really interesting work looking at, in real time, reactions to blood sugar variability. And he's found that most people with diabetes spend a significant amount of time stressed that their diabetes is not in range. It's either hypo, it's hyper, or it's too variable. Right? Yeah. So that, again, completely unique to us.
Yeah.
Completely unique. So all of these things are diabetes distress. Now, you're going to have parts in your life, parts in your day, where this is micro, and you're like, oh God, I can't bother dealing with this now. And then where this is macro, I'm too scared to go to sleep. I have to be up for 3 hours. I'm crying because I'm now really upset. Do you see what I mean? Like, it's yeah. I think there's micro and macro.
Like, it's like that. This is all fine till it's not fine.
It's like a volume knob.
Yeah.
So because we have this unique thing, I think most of us are probably sitting at about 3 all day. Not ideal. It's in the background. You can kind of get on with your work. You're kind of doing whatever. Now, at various points in life, that is going to be up at 11. And yeah. At that point, you need to see someone about that. Like, we wouldn't say this about anxiety or depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, like, it's when it gets to the point where it's affecting your life and it's distressing you in a significant enough way, at that point you should have access to someone who understands what the distress actually is. Because if you go and speak to a psychologist and you explain those symptoms, and that psychologist doesn't understand the nature of type 1 diabetes, then you're going to get diagnosed with depression or anxiety.
Yeah.
You know what I found really odd though, Jack, is that I would say that was absolutely me. Like Mary said, I was going into COVID kind of left to do my own thing diagnosis as an adult. Didn't really get a lot of support. And when I was asking for the psychological support, their answer was to give me technology. But it hasn't actually dealt massively with how I feel. I don't know if that makes sense. It's made a difference.
It makes perfect sense.
But it hasn't solved the issue.
What do you think would help? What do you think would help, then, Kez?
Well, I think it shouldn't be, and I don't, maybe Jack's going to say the same thing, but it shouldn't be one or the other. Like, they should be used together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
My time in range has changed. I'm not making as many decisions as I could be because I'm on a closed loop.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't change how I feel when it doesn't work, or I'm still number watching. I'm still, I still have this really difficult relationship with food. That hasn't gone away.
It's like
because of
essentially putting a plaster over it. It's still the wound is still there, isn't it? And at times your plaster is going to peel away and stuff.
It's still not right though either.
No,
like,
it's not.
Hybrid closed loop is a great thing, but like, you still have to remember to put your bolus in. You still have to inaccurately carb count. You are still judged mm-hmm. by those inaccuracies. And with full CGM and visibility, like, and if you don't have access to the tech, but you have a sensor like a Libre, like, that is a brilliant thing that we're really grateful for and all those things. But if that doesn't help you to live that life or support that child or that loved one,
in a if that adds more stress to it, then it adds more to it. But you have this full-on visibility and judgment from this technology too, by yourself and your care team, that you maybe your care team don't even look at it until they're dealing with you, but you don't see that. You think they're staring at you like Big Brother.
Yes. It sounds to me though that what I hear when you guys are saying that is that the system is essentially telling you, we've given you a pump, what else do you want?
Yeah.
And that is very much reminiscent of what happened when diabulimia started becoming more, when we were so I wasn't involved on the writing team for the NICE guidelines, although I took part in all of the workshops running up to it, but a very good friend of mine was, and we were liaising about what would be the best things to do here, and someone put in that they wanted to have Daphne in there as treatment for diabulimia. Right, now here's the thing, I don't have any problem with Daphne being utilized at the right time for the right person, but to me it smacked of, what do we already do that can take away the pain? Well, they've got problems with food, we know that Daphne works, let's just send them all Daphne. And that's like saying to someone with anorexia, right, we'll send you on a cookery course. Do you know what I mean? There's this thing about, it's again, it's that thing about being reactive in the system rather than proactive.
Yeah.
And being proactive says, yes, tech might make diabetes somewhat easier to manage, but it's not going to take away the diabetes. It's not a cure. There's still, I mean, never mind the system, never mind the systemic things around the patient. Are they getting bullied at school because they've got a Libra on? How is their family reacting to their type 1 diabetes diagnosis? None of this stuff is going to be changed by bunging a pump on it. No. Not that I'm saying that pumps are a bad thing, but it's this notion that anything is a cure-all that bothers me. And on top of that, there are so many unintended consequences that we're seeing now of tech.
Yeah.
That are ironically affecting people psychologically very negatively.
Yeah.
Does that mean we take the pump away? Absolutely not. What we do is we go and we speak to diabetes specific psychologists. We engage the community in a good dialogue with people who actually understand what's going on and say, right, how do we treat these? What are the things that are coming up? And how do we develop psychological models to help people cope with this? Because ultimately we know that this pump is a good thing. But insulin is a good thing, and diabulimic still didn't take it, myself very much included. So it all seems a bit...
It's not quite there.
I don't think it's ever going to be there.
No.
Like, at the end of the day, we live with a very, what can be, a very debilitating, life-threatening illness. And all of us are doing our best to get through every day with the knowledge that we live with this very debilitating, life-threatening illness.
And it's invisible to other people. It's invisible.
Exactly.
And we squash it in ourselves.
I think a lot of the problems, that psychological problems that diabetes comes with, is because we try and make the diabetes smaller than it is.
Yeah, I think so too. What else? Where am I now? Kez, are you? You have questions next, haven't you?
Yeah, I thought we'd just have like a general chat. We've got a few questions. Obviously, the main topic, Jack, of our chat is eating disorders and disordered eating.
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to move into now. I did just want to say, though, because it is something that we talked about, obviously, when me, you and Mary chatted. Guys, we're happy for you to ask questions, but none of us are going to be able to give you medical advice, which is something that Jack mentioned earlier as well. So just bear that in mind when you're kind of asking your questions. So, Jack, I thought we'd start with, can you tell us about the different types of eating disorder in relation to diabetes?
Oh, gosh. Just a small question then. okay, so in general, I think I'll start in general. So most people are aware that there's three main categories of eating disorder now. There's anorexia, which is either the restricting food or restricting and then purging food, but you still end up with a BMI under 18. That's the technical parameters for anorexia. Then you've got bulimia, which is eating larger amounts of food than would be reasonably expected and engaging in compensatory behaviours to get rid of the calories from that food. So that can, the sort of most common presentation of that would be binging and purging. But there's also exercise-based bulimia, where you eat too much and then you massively over-exercise. And then there's also laxative abuse. Then after that, you've got binge eating disorder, which is eating large amounts of food. I can't remember what the exact parameters of it were, but I think it's like, I've heard it, people describe it as bulimia without the purging, and I think that's probably fairly accurate. However, that's how it is in the general population. So for type 1 diabetic eating disorders, or type 1 diabetes and eating disorders, I think things are a little bit different. Starting with binge eating disorder, so there's been in my most recent research, I find a massive increase in binge eating disorder and people identifying a binge eating disorder. But the problem for us is that what actually is a binge in type 1 diabetes, and what defines a binge? And what defines a binge as being related to disordered eating versus what defines a binge as being related to something like hypos or hypers, because hypers can make you extremely hungry also. So the nature of binge eating disorder in type 1 diabetes is not very well defined. Then on top of that, you also have diabulimia. Now, diabulimia is a term, a lot of people have said that it's come out of the media, but it didn't actually. It came out of the Joslin Diabetes Center, which is attached to Harvard in the US, and it sort of emerged towards the end of the 80s. So people say this is a new phenomenon, you can say it's absolutely not. And the person who told me this is Anne Goble Fabry, who actually worked at the Joslin. So it became popularized by the media, having been used by patients as well in the late 80s, but it became popularized in the media towards the end of the 90s, beginning of the noughties, and it specifically relates to not taking the appropriate amount of insulin to deliberately induce weight loss. So that can mean omitting basal, omitting bozo, bolus, omitting both, disconnecting pumps, putting yourself into DKA to lose weight. The main thing here in diabulimia is that it's related to weight loss, or at least that's how we conceptualized it before I left DWED. Now we have to talk about anorexia and bulimia in relation to type 1 diabetes, because this is now getting very confusing as well. The parameters around what constitutes anorexia in a type 1 in someone with type 1 diabetes is also problematic, particularly with the new proliferation of tech. So what is happening is that we're seeing people who are number obsessed, line obsessed. They don't want to break their line, so they're not eating, or they're terrified of getting complications, so they don't want their blood sugar to go high, so they're not eating. And simultaneously, then you've got bulimia, people who are throwing up, people who are purging because they're terrified that what they've eaten is going to affect their blood sugar. So the parameters of what actually eating disorder in type 1 diabetes is very poorly defined. Sorry, that probably doesn't help.
No, it does. It just shows how complicated it is, doesn't it, really? So at like a real basic level, what is the difference between an eating disorder and disordered eating?
I don't think that we know yet. And what's maybe worrying is that the terms are now being used interchangeably. So when I was running DWED, and we wanted to sort of, you've got to remember when I started DWED, so I don't know if Erin's listening, but my friend Erin, who started Diabulimia Helpline in the US, she set up a support group, and she found me on the very far flung corner of the internet where I was running a blog about my own diabulimia, and she invited me to join the support group. And at the time, we were all very severely diabolimic. And the things that we were being told as a group were just, were shocking. Things like, oh, we'd all, I had a doctor actually say to me once, well, we'd all like to lose weight that way. And I just remember thinking, what, and end up with no eyesight or minus a limb. Or you know, my favourite one, that's not real, it's made up on the internet. Or it's just a phase, that's something that came through a lot of time. Or my favourite one, oh no, they're not, they don't have a disorder, they're just being rebellious teenagers. Like the amount of crap coming out about diabulimia was just really, it was so sad. And at the time, of course, what do you do when someone's going through something like this? You tell them, go to the doctor. But yeah. They were coming back to the group just devastated, absolutely devastated. So when I set up DWED, although we did look at all eating disorders, we were focused on diabulimia, as in like this is real. It's a real phenomenon. All of us were singing from exactly the same song sheet. Do you know what I mean? The symptoms, the way that we felt about insulin, the way that we felt about our weight, the way we felt about our body shape. And I think because I'd had an eating disorder previous to being diagnosed, I was like, this is a disorder. This couldn't be any clearer. This is a different type of eating disorder, but it's definitely an eating disorder. Now, to me, putting the word disorder on it means that you get help, right? Because you have anxiety disorders, depressive disorders, eating disorders. So at that point, we very much were saying, this is diabulimia, it's an eating disorder. Because that's what we felt we would have to do to get taken seriously and to get things like diagnostic criteria. Because look, there's huge debates at the moment in psychology, particularly about whether or not anyone should be diagnosed with anything. And I think that some of those arguments are valid, but let me tell you, trying to get support when there is no disorder, there is nothing that's in the, there's nothing that's in the code that your GP doesn't know what to put you through as, was absolutely devastating. I mean, I personally was diagnosed with anorexia. I was like, I've been anorexic. That's not what this is. And I had CBT for anorexia, which of course failed because I didn't have anorexia at that time. So the difference for me when talking about disordered eating rather than having an eating disorder is that disordered eating to me suggests a bit of a problem. But an eating disorder is something that you need help immediately for. But I don't know how right that is. And in fact, the longer that I work in this space, you know, every time I get another qualification, I think I feel like I know less, like I'm less certain about what this is. And I actually think that we need to go back to the community. We need to start doing large scale, global community work to define the boundary, what's a problem and what's a disorder. And to be honest, there's days when I've sat, because I live with gastroparesis, I've sat and I've thought, I'm not eating today. I'm not going to eat today because my stomach's full, I'm really uncomfortable. And then there's an eating disorder voice in the back of my head that goes, good job. So even now, with all of these qualifications, with all of this work in the space, I even struggle myself to sometimes think, what is normal for my diabetic gastroparetic body and what is a mental illness? So to be honest, I don't know if I can give you a good answer for that. I think that that's something that as a community, we need to come together and decide. And even then, The amount of voices that we need in that are huge. Especially, I mean, I always think about the lack of knowledge that we have about dealing with this stuff in men. And also in people of colour, because there's the research dearth is massive. Like there's, as much as we are now starting to catch up to diabulimia as real, it's now at the time where the input of technology means diabulimia, I think it's always going to be there, but it's not where it was 10 or 15 years ago. Rates are coming down. But what we're starting to see is anorexia, bulimia and binge eating disorder. People who identify with those terms going up. So what's changed? The proliferation of technology. So I guess, I mean, I would love to give you like a good solid answer, but I don't really think it would be my place to do that until the research has been done.
Jack, you talked about, can I butt in? I'm sorry. You talked about like it changing from diabulimia, like the diabulimia reducing, and these other eating disorders, disordered eating types, starting to increase because of technology. What's the difference with not using an insulin pump and diabulimic rates being higher and using an insulin pump and them being lower? Like what's that difference?
So I personally have some theories on this, but these are personal theories. They're not backed up by research evidence at all. The first thing to say is that there is some academic literature out there on how using pumps reduces rates of disordered eating. And if anybody ever followed a Twitter I used to run called PA1D, Psychological Aspects in Type 1 Diabetes, I used to tweet out all of the papers. It is there somewhere. So I think probably because it's attached, because it's, okay, bear with me.
You're getting your basal, to stop taking your basal, mentally stop taking that, whereas you can very quickly not take your basal one night and then you're away without it for 24 hours.
Yeah, but also like injecting, and by the way, this is just me thinking out loud, injecting for me was very active. It meant that 6 times a day, sometimes more, I was pulling something out, looking at it, knowing it was going to make me fat and injecting it into me. It was excruciating psychologically. It was an act that I had to do. Whereas not injecting was much more passive for me. It was much more like, well, this is something that I do when I absolutely have to, and in the meantime, I'm losing weight. Brilliant. But having an insulin pump, to me, it was like having an organ attached. For me, psychologically, I'm only talking for myself here, it was like having an organ attached to me. And funnily enough, that made me feel a lot more passive about it. But I think that's because that could be related to that very early experience I had of losing a lot of weight and then putting a lot on very quickly because I was hospitalized. So for me, injecting became ritualized, and that ritual was not, it wasn't something I wanted to engage in because it was a ritual of making myself fatter in my head. Whereas my pump never had that. Now, from other people that I've spoken to, they've said similar things. They've said similar things about when they were injecting. Like, we used to have conversations at Dread about, like, in your worst nightmares, what is insulin? And people would say things like lard, oil, fat. Do you know what I mean? So these really sort of negative, almost like delusions about insulin and about injecting and about that whole rigmarole and that ritual.
And that association.
And so then adding on top of that, the surveillance aspect of having a pump. So nobody's going to check if you're not injecting, right? But if you go to your diabetes clinic and they're downloading your pump, then that's a very different experience. And I think that that's also what's happening now with the Dexcoms and the Libras. There's a surveillance aspect to it that means that, you know, if you are someone who is going to go to all of your diabetes appointments, is maybe feeling ashamed of your eating disorder, then you're going to do everything you can not to be shamed in that clinic appointment. And that does happen when you have, you know, 24-hour surveillance via Libra or Dexcom. So I think that is now changing to people being almost obsessive about those lines. And that's a new way into developing something like a more standard anorexia or bulimia-like presentation by either not eating enough or not eating when you should eat or eating at the wrong times, or you go all day and you've not eaten because your line's good, now you're binging at night, like all of that stuff.
Yeah,
but it's linked into the newer technologies and the way that we're sort of being surveilled a little bit.
But bulimia isn't that much more immediately serious, because you're ending up in DKA very quickly, without taking any insulin. And like, so TEC is in lots of ways saving lives.
But you're talking about risk, right? So if you're talking about risk, then diabulimia is up there. Like, that is just how diabulimia works. You only have to decide, I'm not going to take my insulin today, once, for it to be fatal.
Yeah.
But that can't negate the long-term effects of these other things.
So
I think the issue is that we finally caught up to, okay, we need a treatment plan for diabulimia, but there's no treatment plan for, oh my God, my Lebertrace is dominating my life.
Yeah.
And now, because of that, it's dominating my food. And now, because of that, it's dominating my weight. And so now I've fallen into an eating disorder, right?
You have your clinician seeing your good A1C and saying, you're the type of diabetic we don't need to see.
Well, this is the thing. And also, like, previously, so you've got to remember, DSM-5 came out in 2013, right? So previously to that, we were saying, okay, it's diabulimia as an eating disorder because it's primarily driven by weight and shape, right? So now, great, that's our definition of a disorder, driven by weight and shape. But then in 2013, you have binge eating disorder, which isn't driven by that. So we can't really say that now either. But I think previously my answer would have been, it's a disorder if it's driven by your weight and shape. It's disordered if it's not.
It's really difficult, isn't it? Because I would say, and I'm quite open about this, I had anxiety before I was diabetic. I had issues with food before I was diabetic. But like you said, it was when you were diagnosed with anorexia, when you were saying it wasn't. With the type 1, I found that there were lots of issues with the diagnostics, because they sent me to an all-age eating disorder service and they were like, this is diabetes psychology. There is no diabetes psychology in our area. So it was like I said, we'll have technology, but that hasn't actually dealt with the issue. Like, it's, I had the Libra before, but it was that, well, my levels are too high. If I eat now, I'm going to end up much, much higher.
Yeah.
So I'm just not going to.
Yeah.
And then it will come down, you know, I'll either inject or it'll come down or whatever. And then I'll end up with this amazing time in range.
Yeah, and funnily enough, like you were saying about the diagnostics, if you're using a standard, like screener, which very often happens in primary care to decide where you get put, where, you know, what mental health service you get referred to, that alone means that you're anorexia risk, but it doesn't take any of the context.
Oh.
So that was my last piece of research, was on, basically why all of the screeners for eating disorders in type 1 are crap and we shouldn't be using any of them, because they don't contextualize why someone with type 1 diabetes might be doing something. So why did you decide not to eat? Why are you avoiding whole food groups? Why do you only drink diet soda? And yes, these are all questions on common screeners.
It's a totally different condition to, like, diabetes is just like this umbrella. Like, even within type 2, there are different ways it's managed. And like, so however you manage a condition, or however that condition is in the body, like, it makes so much sense that you would have something specific for that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and there is a specific screener for diabetes, but it's not taking the role of diabetes technology into consideration. So this is the thing, we're always kind of like, I think with how slowly systems move, we're behind what's actually going on at the coalface. And that's why I think there needs to be a much larger, consistent conversation with the community. Because the community can tell you this if you ask them the right questions. They'll be like, oh yeah, that's because I'm going to have a great time in range. Well, where's that on your screener?
And I thought that was really interesting with the, so on the, I think it's Living With, isn't it, with the Steady, the app. So you get your questionnaires on there, but they are pretty much the same anxiety. Yes, they're called diabetes distress, but the, like you said, the questions don't necessarily directly relate to what you are or not not doing in relation to your diabetes.
Yeah, and this is another problem. Of there's a lack of, I think, valid psychometrics. There's a lack of valid psychometrics that are, that have come out of the community saying, well, wait a minute, what about this? Because, you know, I've been reading through a lot recently, and I'm like, right, okay, let's have a look. Who's doing their PPI? Who's talking to the patients? Oh, look, there wasn't a patient within a million miles of the development of this questionnaire. Standard. And I don't know, I'd maybe feel that COVID pushed us back a little bit there, because there was a time, like just before COVID, where this was becoming the new, this is the best way to do this. We do everything via co-production. And certainly that's what Steady did, looking into all of these different models of co-production. And then COVID kind of came along and just sort of shut a lot of that down. But I think as well, there's a bit of an old-fashioned medical way of not doing things online. Oh, you have to be in person for this, you have to be in person for that. So my hope is that that is going to change. And it will have to change by the nature of people who are doing the research. But I do have some meetings next week to talk about some large-scale studies, co-productive studies, that I'm hopefully going to be involved in. So, yeah, I think it's just getting in front of the right people, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So I read something today on Twitter. It said, if you're not at the table, you're not on the menu. And I thought, that's so true. I think it was somebody saying about, like, because, you know, Diabetes UK professional conference has just passed and they weren't talking about eye screening a lot. And so that popped up. If you're not sitting at the table, then you're not on the menu. And I do think, like, because of diabulimia, I was on the menu for a really long time. I don't know how you guys feel about this, but I think there's a sort of movement of, like, when patients, and I count myself within this, when we're in the room, when we're in these environments, like, it can be very overwhelming. You're often the person who's doing, you know, the majority of the emotional labour. You're potentially not being paid to be there. And there's a feeling that we should just be grateful to be at the table. Well, I say that table is made of my body parts. You know, like, for us as type 1 diabetics, our body is the table. And so I'm hoping to sort of bring a bit of that energy back, I think, because I'm a little bit concerned about the lack of our voices being involved in these big sort of decisions at the moment.
I really like that analogy, like that our body is the table.
Yeah, Jack. That's great.
And like I'm involved in things here locally, and you know, when you are, like, it does feel like you're slitting your wrists and talking about your life, like, to
over and over.
Yes, exactly. Over and over and over, to the point where you actually think that they're not listening, and not actually, you're wasting your time and you're just ticking boxes.
And I used to have a really strong term for this, so warning, but I used to call it, oh my, I'm gonna have to go to this meeting and prostitute my grief.
Oh my gosh, I'm gonna write that down. I'm laughing. I like, there's nothing else to do but laugh at that. But that's
so
is
true,
it.
Though. It's so true.
And if you don't, you have regrets because you haven't said it, and you need to say it. So that at least it's out of your body, and in case they have never ever experienced or heard that in relation to whatever they're talking about. And then you have no regrets for saying it, but like, you're just annoyed that, like, you're whispering into the wind. There's a more graphic term, but like, we'll just say it's whispering into the wind.
Yeah. No, like, I, like, so many times that's how I've felt. And that's why, you know, I know we're sort of like joking about like me just getting multiple degrees, but it's like, it's almost been like, how else can I dodge having to do this again? Like, how do I get to walk into a room and not have to prostitute my grief, not have to, you know, traumatize myself again. Because, you know, like I said, unfortunately, I've lost a lot of people to bulimia. And I sort of sometimes feel like I have to remind people, people have died of this, you know, and they weren't just people to me. They were my best friends.
Yeah. And
that's difficult.
I think that's really, I don't, now that the words are, I don't know how you do it, like, but you've no choice.
But you remember who you're doing it for, right? That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last question of this section, really, Jack, that I'll be interested to know before we look at more about DWED and the advocacy and peer support is, what do you think is most important for healthcare professionals to know when they're working with diabetes and either eating disorder or disordered eating? What would you want them to know?
I think actually it's something that most of us probably say. There's two things. I think the first one would be like, and this is something that I've seen, I didn't really appreciate this until I started working clinically. And it's something that I knew and I felt deeply and deeply myself. But when you're working with other patients who have similar struggles to you, is that appointment with that healthcare professional, especially like if you're working with a consultant, for example, is half an hour of that consultant's life once a year. We have to deal with this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if you say to someone, oh, make this small change, that's every day for a year that you're asking that person to make a change. What if it doesn't work? If it doesn't work, if that then puts that person at risk, if it means that they can't drive to school to pick up their kids, if it means that they can't sleep through the night and have a decent day at work, then yes, they're going to be quote unquote non-compliant because your advice is a risk. And that everything that is said in those clinic appointments, it might only be half an hour of your time, of my time as a clinician, but it's that person's however long till I see them again. So this, just try this little thing, is totally reductive and unrealistic. If you're going to say that, let's try this little thing, then you have to provide avenues for immediate feedback. If it's 3 days later and the patient is now hypo-AF and, you know, like, is say they're working on roofs or whatever, then they're not going to do what you've said. There has to be recourse to say, the advice that you've given me isn't working and it's not my fault. I'm not going. I don't want to turn back up in the appointment and be spoken to like I'm a naughty little girl or I'm a naughty little boy. I didn't follow that advice because it wasn't working for my life. That would be the first thing. The second thing to say, what would be, gosh, diabetes psychology is evolving. It is constantly evolving. It's a relatively new field, but it is absolutely vital. So if you are in a situation where you don't have access to a diabetes specialist psychologist, or if that diabetes specialist psychologist doesn't understand eating disorders, then you have to, as a group of patients, we have to get involved locally and start making noise and complaining about it. And that's why I'm bringing DWED back. So for ages, I thought it wasn't going to be DWED, but it is going to be DWED 2.0, called something else, because I think, again, as a community, need to get together and start putting pressure on the right people.
Oh, thanks, Jack. That was a really amazing section. And what you've just said leads in really nicely to the next bit that Mary's going to do around the mental health advocacy and peer support.
Oh gosh, I'm just here scribbling loads of notes because like that was epic, Jack. And I know I'm going to forget them. And like the bit about like DWED 2.0, I know that from the other night, like I know even more like that how important it will be and it was. And but
from the other night and hearing you tonight.
Jeepers, I know how hard it's going to be, like, for you. And what does mental health mean to you? This is like a huge thing. Like, not Duet 2.0, but like all this thing now. This is all like your work. And what does mental health, like, what does that mean to you?
Do you mean to me as someone with type 1 diabetes, or to me as someone working in mental health, or as an academic? Actually, do you know what?
As all those together. I mean good mental health.
Okay, this is what it means to me, really simply. Diabetes sucks. It absolutely and utterly sucks. It is an absolute ball ache of a chronic illness. And it doesn't have to be any harder. So good mental health means that I am able to live with my diabetes while recognizing that it sucks and knowing that it is very easy to fall off the tightrope when you're forced to balance on it to survive. So all I want to do is provide people with a net for when they inevitably fall off the tightrope.
Oh, that's gosh, it. I have goosebumps on my knees. Like, that is just, imagine knowing you had a net. Just that even it was there.
Yep.
Oh.
Just to bounce back up. Just to give you that bit more support.
Yeah.
That bit more encouragement.
Oh, I love that too. Yeah. Sorry, I'm writing this down.
But that's what mental health support should be.
Yeah.
It's a net, because this is an impossible balancing act. And yeah, Everyone is going to fall off that rope at some point. Good mental health support means that the shortest time for you to get back on the rope. So hopefully what that means for me is providing the research, providing a good psychological diabetes service, being the best diabetes psychologist I can be. And then also having a charity, having a third sector voice that is able to sort of hold the system, which, if we really want to go conceptual, are the two pins that hold that rope in place to make sure that they are banging it into the ground the way that they should be. So yeah, I suppose that's it. Yeah,
that's just
incredible. And
that's good.
I'm just going to tweet out, guys, because I'm aware of the time as well for our open forum, and I want to hear from the community as well. So I'm just going to put, what does mental health mean to you, and what do you do to improve your mental health? So feel free.
What does good mental health mean to you? Like, because, yeah, I don't know. I think when we say mental health, we're like, just, I don't know, maybe it's me. Like, I think, oh, that's the negative bit. Like, that's like, oh, that's my mental health. Like, it's not great. Like, but it's what does the good, what should it look like?
Yes, yes.
What should it feel like? Yeah.
Also, I have to shout out to my bestie, because I know that she's listening. So she's my good mental health net, Sandy. She's on the chat.
Class. What do you call her?
Insulin junkie is her.
Oh, I see her.
Yeah.
Sandy, you've been in here all the time. Yeah. What was I going to say now? Distracted by a lovely thing. Jack, what support? This is a big question. What support are you aware of? And you mentioned Duet 2.0, so that's something in the future coming back, not today or tomorrow, but what's out there right now that like people could go to or ask for, or should be just even asking for, knowing that it's not there?
Well, there's pilot studies for both eating disorders and disordered eating. Kind of, there's one in Bournemouth called the Compassion Project, And then I think that that's now been made a permanent service. Then there's the Tide Clinic in London. That's at King's College London, run by some absolutely and utterly fantastic women who have been absolute pioneers in this space. But I think that's for more, they're definitely on the more severe diabulimia and also like comorbid, like mental health comorbidity side. But if you're, I know that they have inpatient services as well. Then there's various research projects. I'm not sure if Steady's still recruiting. I should probably know that given that I'm PPI manager on it. But Steady, which is for, is not, you don't have to be as severe diabulimia. That's for more what we probably would say is like disordered eating going on at King's College. But it's important to say that that's like a randomized control study. So you might get onto the project, but you also might not. Then there's, I think that's kind of it at the moment.
Any Facebook groups then for
So there's Diabulimia Helpline run, the largest one in the world, which is called Diabulimia Awareness on Facebook. And they've got like thousands of members there now. We run a small one, but it is small. If you go via the DWED website, dwed.org.uk, it's called Tide UK, and there's a friends and family group there if there's any parents or siblings or partners who are struggling to cope with their loved one's eating disorder.
Yeah.
But I think when DWED comes back, which won't actually be too far off, I'm looking in the next sort of 2 to 3 months, we're going to be doing sort of like peer support facilitated group therapy type stuff, and then also like just rant rooms. So watch this space for that, because DWED is coming back.
Rant rooms,
yeah.
Love us. Love the name.
Diabulimia, it sucks. Diabetic eating disorders suck. And it's important, I think, for us just to have a space to go, this sucks. on top of then also maybe having some online therapeutic groups, which I'll be running.
Lovely. Gosh, brilliant.
Once I'm actually qualified.
Friday.
Like forever.
When you do this is a tangent. When you do your Viva on Friday, how long does it take for you for it to all fall in? I should know this because I'm married to my husband's in academia, but like I don't know some of the connections.
I don't know. So my like PhD Viva was 3-4 hours, I think. Maybe longer. I think I've trauma blacked that one out as well. And then my Declan Viva, I think will run probably about 2 hours.
Okay. And then it's like celebrations? Like you've passed?
Or commiserations.
Celebrations. No, positive, yeah. Mental attitude.
Yeah. I think the thing is though that like the sort of disdain that I have for the way that the system is currently being run just drips through my entire thesis. So it depends whether or not they agree with me or whether they think that I'm just being snarky. So
Oh, we'll be thinking about you on Friday.
maybe we'll have to do what we've said we'll do for Tom when he goes to see his consultant. And like have a, what was it called? Someone remind me. What was it? What were we looking for?
Oh, I can't remember now. A unite or something. I don't know.
What, like a UPS for people with type 1 diabetes?
It was rebellious. Basically, they said no. We'll all come after them.
You're all coming to my consultant appointment on Wednesday, right?
I know. You say no to Tom, you say no to all of us.
I love this idea of like unionizing patient care. I'm talking to see you for my diabetes consultant. I'm bringing my union rep.
Yes.
It's all of us.
Yeah. You mind if I just live stream this on Twitter?
Yeah. Yeah, I've written this down too. Honestly, my brain is just like not holding any information long enough.
It's been tonight. such a fascinating chat tonight, hasn't it? Really, really empowering. And it's just been phenomenal.
So informative.
And I hope to God it's helped people. It certainly helped me in certain ways. And I know, Jack, we spoke about it briefly, and I caught on to it when I was at the gym, about talking about these sort of things, like you say, with men. And you know what I mean? I think it's very important to talk about this with everyone, men, female, like you said, people of color, and everyone. But for men, I think men maybe keep things in, and maybe don't talk about these things. So yeah, I think we've got a gem in you, Jack. I think you're a gold star, and everything you do for the community and it's just phenomenal, and just we're so thankful. And if anyone can help with the TWED community, please contact Jack, and I'm sure you can get discussions going.